Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, no, seriously, this time the Fed really means it because, well, you know why.
What we've seen the last 6 months isn't it.
Ben Bernanke rides again from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday. It's the 13th of September today. Good to have you with us, as always. And we begin with nothing less than the future of the American economy. It comes to us, as it usually has the past 4 years or so, in the person of Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. The Fed wrapped up a big meeting today by doing what a lot of people had been hoping it would do. The central bank is going to try one more time to kick the economy into gear. It's going to buy up debt, bonds, that is, drive long-term interest rates even lower than they are, and in so doing, convince people and banks that it's okay to borrow money and, more importantly, spend it. Our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, has been on the Fed story today. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so did I oversell it? I mean, this is a big deal, right?
This is a huge deal. It's a really astonishing moment, a historical moment for the Federal Reserve and what it wants to do for the economy. They are going to buy mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to the tune of $40 billion a month.
Wow.
And they're not saying when they're going to stop. So this is a long-term, or looks like a long-term strategy where the Fed is admitting that the economy needs a lot of help.
Say that one more time. This is open-ended, $40 billion a month.
This is absolutely open-ended, and they didn't want to commit to any timing, even before 2015,
wow,
about when to end the Fed involvement in the markets, which is fascinating.
Okay, two questions as a result. One, what took them so long? And two, what's this going to do to the real economy, to jobs and making people feel better?
Yeah. Well, what took them so long is that they've actually been doing this since 2009. So this is called quantitative easing, and it's the third round of it. And it's kind of been a similar strategy since 2009. And the Fed is basically going all in. They're saying, we can't predict when this is going to end, so we're just going to keep doing it. And then as to what it does for the real economy, what they want to do is bring down the jobless rate. That's really important to them. But it's more like, I mean, let's take it to Sesame Street. Okay, so if you had to think of the Fed as a Sesame Street character, you might think Oscar the Grouch, you might think the Count, but actually think the Cookie Monster.
Okay,
so the stock market runs on a sugar rush. They like things that give them a sugar rush.
Yes,
you know, quick returns like Treasury bonds or those mortgage-backed securities that we talked about.
Yep.
So the Fed has become the Cookie Monster. It buys up all of the cookies and it gives the markets a sugar rush, but that creates a problem. I talked to Anthony Sanders. He's a finance professor at George Mason University.
The problem is the Fed doesn't have anything nutritious on its shelves. They're just doing sugar highs. The stock market right now is getting a sugar rush. But the problem is the real economy doesn't thrive on sugar rushes. It thrives on nutritious foods, which the Fed can't give out.
Right. And the markets today, I mean, they love this, right?
They live for this stuff.
Yeah.
This is a great day in the markets because they know that the Federal Reserve is going to be there for them as long as they need it with almost, you know, what is really an unlimited amount of money.
Right. Okay. So we asked listeners actually on our Twitter feed what they would want to know about this thing. And here's a good one actually from Andrew Nock. He says, how do we measure its success? How are we going to know that this $40 billion a month from now till the end of time is working?
Well, it's going to be like what the Supreme Court said about pornography. They'll know it when they see it.
You're all over the place today, man.
It's
we got
kind
Sesame
of,
Street
it's,
and porn.
I know, from one extreme to another. But really, it is that they're not going to look at a single economic measure. The Fed is going to look at the whole economy and judge when it's really getting on its feet. And only then will it end this involvement.
All right. Heidi Moore in New York. More on this one to come, I'm sure. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you.
All right. Now for some completely different Washington policy news. It seems the Food and Drug Administration is cracking down on the beauty industry. L'Oreal is the latest big cosmetics company to get a stern warning letter from regulators. The FDA says L'Oreal has to tone down the claims on some of its anti-aging products, or it's going to have to submit them for a formal FDA drug review. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more now on the growing market for cosmeceuticals.
cosmetics are getting complicated, and the FDA doesn't like it. The agency's Tamara Ward says by law, a cosmetic is
a product that is used to cleanse, beautify, promote attractiveness, etc.
Not a product that claims to, in the FDA's language, alter the body's function or structure.
Jenny Feek from Lancome. Inspired by 10 years of research on genes.
L'Oreal's advertising says that 1 ounce bottle of cream serum boosts the activity of genes and stimulates production of youth proteins. L'Oreal hasn't responded yet to the FDA, but there's a lot at stake here. Anti-aging lotions and potions are now 13% of all cosmetic sales and growing. Karen Doskow is a market researcher at Klein & Company.
Even in a downturn, a very soft economy, people are still very concerned about aging and are willing to spend upwards of $100 on aging products.
And it's not just wrinkled baby boomers. It's 30 and 40-somethings desperate not to look like them. Analyst Radia Amari at Ibis World expects L'Oreal will simply adjust its advertising so its cosmeceuticals don't sound as much like a pharmaceutical.
But it's already experienced increasing sales for the products. So then worth it for the company.
That little 1 ounce bottle of Genifique, we found it online selling for $84 at Neiman Marcus. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Oh, heck yeah. Wall Street liked what the Fed had to say today. We will have the details and the happy music when we do the numbers. Our education reporter Amy Scott did a story not too long ago about a school in Cincinnati called Euler. It's part of what's known as the community schools movement, which says education by itself isn't enough to get kids out of poverty. You have to improve their environments at the same time. Amy was there for the first day of school at Euler back in August. She's going to be going back through the rest of the school year exploring how this one school is trying to make a difference in a community. Today, the man who's leading the charge.
High school, listen up. Guys are bright and early, bright and early. High school only, listen up.
Just after dawn, Principal Craig Hockenberry stands outside Euler School like a beacon in his lime green shirt and sky blue tie. He greets students as they line up to go inside.
When you guys arrive, every single morning, you guys come to this door right here, rain or shine.
It's the first day back at the old school after 2 years away. Euler moved up the hill a mile or so during a $21 million renovation.
Today's going to be crazy getting used to the new building, but we'll get it. Each day will get better and better, okay?
The first day of school marks the end of a tough summer in a tough neighborhood. Just before the break, a fifth grade student and her mother were stabbed to death. Then an Euler parent was murdered right across the street from the school. White styrofoam cups still spell out his name, Brian, in the chain-link fence. Hockenberry says during the 2 years the school was closed for renovation, the drugs and violence down here got worse.
I could walk you outside the door, not even 15 steps away, and I could probably get just about any drug that I want. I could walk you another 15 feet down, and there are our parents that are prostituting and are hooked on heroin and crack cocaine. Parents that used to be on my PTA.
Euler is in Lower Price Hill. It's a small neighborhood of brick row houses overlooking the Ohio River. The culture is known as urban Appalachian. When coal mining jobs in Kentucky and West Virginia dried up after the Second World War, families came here for factory jobs. But those are mostly gone, too. Many get by on welfare and food stamps. Donna Jones has lived here off and on her whole life.
Families that have been here for a long time have married other families. So there's a lot of, oh, that's my daughter-in-law's family, or, you know, that's my son-in-law's family. I consider us a close-knit community.
Euler School looms large in that community with its long history and imposing brick and terracotta architecture. Jones went there, so did her kids and now grandkids.
It's more than a school. You know, it's like the hub of activity.
That's no accident. Euler is what's known as a community learning center. It's part of a growing movement in education that says if you're going to help poor kids succeed in school, you have to fight the effects of poverty. Euler's teamed up with nonprofits and government agencies to put in a health center and a vision clinic. The school's open from early morning till late at night. Kids can eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner there and take home food on weekends. With a new daycare and preschool, Hockenberry says Euler now serves kids from age 6 weeks to 22.
In theory, there should be no kid, no child, or anybody in our community not getting full services here, you know? And if they're not, then we're going to address it pretty quickly.
He says academically, all the services are making a difference. Test scores are slowly improving. But the school has a long way to go. And this year, Hockenberry has another goal.
I want to start working on the neighborhood, the actual neighborhood, the streets. I mean, I want, you know, the boards to come down off the houses. I want less crime and people from outside our community coming in and selling drugs. You know, I want people to come and see this as a great school in a great neighborhood.
And so after school, he walks the streets.
Hello, everybody. How are you? Good.
Any problems at school today? Are you on little ones there?
Still wearing his suit and tie, Hockenberry greets parents smoking on their front stoops and hassles kids he didn't see in the halls that day.
You weren't in school today because you graduated, right?
Hockenberry is a baby-faced 40-year-old. A former teacher who stumbled into a job at Euler in his mid-20s and got hooked on the challenge of turning it around. He lives nearby in Price Hill and knows pretty much everybody around here by name, like the lanky young man in a glittery red T-shirt he spots across the street.
Roy, what's up with it? Are you staying out of trouble?
Roy Lee has not been staying out of trouble. He's facing a drug charge. Lee is 24 years old and dropped out years ago. Hockenberry pushes him to come back and finish at Euler's online high school.
I still can enroll. I only need like 5 or 6 credits.
All right, I tell you what, I'm going to give you a one-time deal. You come over there and let's do it, okay? Your grandma would be so proud of you, man.
You did her wrong for so long.
Lee promises to stop by the next morning at 9 o'clock. Hockenberry finishes his rounds.
Them seeing me out here all the time gives them a chance to actually ask some questions. Like, I will follow up with Roy. I really want Roy to go back to school, and I really want him to get a job. And I'll find out if he's good for his word tomorrow.
With that, he goes off to kick some older kids off the preschool playground.
Hey, guys, come here. Come here. Everybody.
An ice cream truck rolls by, a reminder of the waning summer. The next day, Roy Lee doesn't show. But a few days later, he does. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Take a second, check out a slideshow of the Euler School and some of the voices you heard in Amy's piece. It's at marketplace.org. Straight ahead, riding a Harley Davidson down the street of eternal happiness in Shanghai does not come cheap.
So here they're starting at about 20,000 and working their way up to 45,000 because of all the taxes. And a license plate for a motorcycle costs $8,000 US.
But first, let's do the numbers. There you go, the very happy music. I knew that was going to be it. The Dow Industrial surged 206 points today, more than 1.5%, closed at 13,539. The NASDAQ bounced 41 points, 1.3%, 3155 at the bell. The S&P 500 advanced 23 points. That is almost 1.2%, 1459 the number you're looking for there. Today's rally lifted stocks to fresh highs not seen in almost 5 years, in case you're keeping track. Financial shares, yeah, they were up. Stock in Bank of America rang up 4.75% today. Citigroup rose 4.25%. Investors made a connection with the new iPhone 5 despite that weird new plug thing. I don't know about that. Apple stock climbed to another all-time closing high, nearly $683 a share. Hello, 700. Rose another 2% in case you're keeping track there. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for August. Did consumers pay more or less for stuff like food, gas, and clothing last month? The Labor Department releases its monthly consumer price index for August. And the 2012 U.S. Olympic and Paralympic teams are honored at the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. From APM, I'm Kai Rizdahl. The ink was barely dry on the statement from the Federal Reserve today before it became the latest political prop of this presidential election season. Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee said Mr. Bernanke is, quote, beginning to do serious damage to the Fed as an institution. I'll pause here to note that 11 of the 12 members of the Federal Open Market Committee voted for the new policy today. Be that as it may, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports the Fed and presidential politics aren't exactly strangers.
The Federal Reserve is a creature of Congress, created on Capitol Hill almost 100 years ago. Stuart Hoffman is a former Fed economist, now at PNC Financial. He says Fed chairmen started staking out their independence after World War II, but it's always been a struggle.
They're like a grown-up adult. Your parents still try to influence you and give you good advice, but especially as you mature, you know, you should do what you feel best.
And resist pressure from, say, a president who wants you to juice the economy so he can get reelected. Hoffman says former Fed Chair Arthur Burns bent to that kind of pressure from President Nixon. But since then, our Fed chairmen have been more independent. Bob McTeer was president of the Dallas Fed during Alan Greenspan's term. He says, remember Greenspan's famous Fed speak?
Modest preemptive actions can obviate the need of more drastic actions at a later date.
McTeer says Greenspan was able to make everybody hear what they wanted to hear.
It was a defensive weapon, a shield, not a spear.
Cut to current chairman Ben Bernanke. He's been the target of criticism from both sides of the political aisle. He was appointed by President Bush, then reappointed by President Obama. Alan Blinder is a Princeton economist and former Fed vice chair. He says the bipartisan carping has actually helped Bernanke.
The fact that he's going to be damned if he does and damned if he doesn't incrementally makes it easier to just do the right thing.
Even Blinder says right before a presidential election. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The Gallup Economic Confidence Index was up last week. Now it's near its highs for the year, which is promising. But as always with economic indicators, what the numbers say needs a little interpretation.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup, and seeing as how they're his numbers, we thought we'd ask him what they mean. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So what's going on with these numbers? We are getting increasingly confident, you tell us.
Well, what's going on is politics. At this time of year, when you ask somebody how's the weather, they're going to answer based on their political orientation. Certainly when we measure consumer confidence, we're seeing the same thing. The numbers shot up last week. That was concomitant with the Democratic convention. Obama was getting a bounce. And sure enough, when we look at our data, Kai, it's Democrats most of all who increased their economic confidence last week. Independents a little less. And Republicans, flat as a pancake.
Let me read between the lines. Are you telling me that people's political views influence how they view what would otherwise be objective economic news?
That's right. When you ask somebody about the economy, you don't mention politics at all. And yet, particularly in a political season, people see that as a referendum on the president in particular. If they're a Democrat, they say, yeah, things are going well. If you're a Republican, they say, absolutely not. I can't agree with anything that's positive with a Democrat in the White House.
Isn't that a little depressing? I mean, honestly.
We certainly know, speaking of depressing, that when you ask people how's economic news these days, Republicans, and this was in a Pew study that they just put out, Kai, 60% said the news they are hearing about the economy recently has been bad Only 15% of Democrats said that. So Republicans are depressed in general because of their political orientation. Yeah. And Democrats say, hey, things are going well because we have our person in the White House.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Frank, and it is political. It's become a political issue here. It's the violence in the Middle East, and both the president and Governor Romney have been going back and forth at each other about this one. Do events like this tend to influence a political opinion in this country?
They do. In certain instances, they're what we call, Kai, rally events. And regardless of who the president is, people tend, at least temporarily, to rally around the president when things happen. The biggest rally event in our history was 9/11.
Yeah.
Bush's job approval rating shot up by 35 points after that. Then we had a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter. Hostages were taken in Iran, and his job approval rating in the short term went up. And there are a lot of other examples in similar ways.
Yeah. And does proximity to an election factor in? I mean, we're, what, 60 days away?
I would say in general they can be short-lived. Jimmy Carter's job approval shot up, but then it had fallen down the next year as he was running for president down into the 20s, and he lost. So I think they can be short-lived. Again, it depends on what happens in the weeks thereafter, but they're not permanent.
Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Our segment with him that we do every week is called Attitude Check. You can find out more on our website, which is, of course, marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
The big news out of China this week is about a guy who's gone missing. Ordinarily not a global story, unless the man who hasn't been seen in public in 10 days or so is in line to be the next president of China. Xi Jinping's absence from the public eye is leading to much speculation about his health and his whereabouts. But China is, after all, a country of 1.3 billion people, all of whom are trying to live their lives and make a living. Our correspondent Rob Schmitz is in the middle of a year-long series about the Chinese economy, the people and the places that make it work. There are stories from a single street in Shanghai. It's called the Street of Eternal Happiness. Here's Rob.
It's Friday night at the intersection of the Street of Eternal Happiness and a street named Fumin. That means rich people in Chinese. Tonight, both streets live up to their names. Wealthy, drunk foreigners and Chinese stumble out of dance clubs. Outside, dealers openly sell marijuana. On the corner, people throw coins at a monkey performing tricks. The only thing missing here is a motorcycle gang. Uh-oh. A couple dozen Chinese guys dressed in black leather park their Harleys. The monkey scurries out of the way. The group struts past a Mexican-themed cantina and a bunch of seedy bars gathering stares. And just when you think there's going to be trouble, they stroll into a coffee bean and tea leaf where they buy each other lattes and cappuccinos. This is a motorcycle gang of Chinese executives and self-made millionaires. They meet for coffee here every Friday night. The Hell's Angels, Chinese style.
Oh, generally we just drink coffee and sit around and talk.
Jim Rice is the head road captain of the Harley Owners Group Shanghai, Hogs for short. He's the China CEO of the Dutch food company CSM, and he's one of the only Americans in the group. He introduces me to the rest of the gang.
Frank makes sweaters. Yeah. Jerry, that just pulled up, builds prisons for city governments. Chen Jun makes clothes, designer clothes. We have Tony Tang is a diamond wholesaler. What else we got? Winston has a shipping company that ships coal around. Between us, we probably know everybody in town as far as they go. Ni hao, ni hao.
Jim greets another rider in Chinese. This is quite possibly the best-connected motorcycle gang on the planet, and they all drive Harleys, considered luxury items in China. In the U.S., a typical Harley will run you from $8,000 to $20,000, not in China.
So here they're starting at about $20,000 and working their way up to $45,000 because of all the taxes.
U.S. dollars.
U.S. dollars, yeah. And a license plate for a motorcycle costs $8,000 U.S. in Shanghai. So these are very expensive. It's a very expensive hobby. One Friday night, we got rained out and everybody drove their cars, and this whole area was full of Bentleys and Ferraris and Land Rovers. And
one of the riders, a guy named Xiao Wen, was the first employee of Harley-Davidson in China when the company opened its first dealership here 7 years ago. He says it was perfect timing, taking their cue from a culture of riding in the U.S., rich Chinese were ready to hit the road.
The highway system in China
is developed very fast recent years. So we also have the same reason to have a Harley, to have a very happy ride on the highway.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway.
In China, there's now plenty of highway to ride. The country's paved 32,000 miles of highways in the past 8 years. The world's most expansive road-building campaign since America built the interstate system 50 years ago. An era that heralded a culture of riders in the U.S. is doing the same in China. 51-year-old Zhu Zhonglin owns a cashmere sweater company. He shows me photos of him on his Harley on remote mountain passes in Tibet, China's northwestern province of Xinjiang, and from a ride across Africa. He owns more than a dozen motorcycles. Three of them are Harleys. He spent $90,000 on his newest one. And then there's rider Jerry Gong.
These days, whenever I'm not at work, I'm on my motorcycle.
Gong bought his first Harley 4 months ago. He says after spending his life building prisons for the Chinese government, he was feeling a little trapped.
A motorcycle doesn't have a roof, a window, nor a door. It gives me a sense of freedom. It lets me indulge my passion for life. The city can get very depressing, and when you ride your car to work stuck in such a confined space, it makes me even more depressed.
And for Frank, seller of cashmere sweaters, Winston, shipper of coal, Jerry, builder of prisons, and the rest of the group, China's rapid rise has given them wealth, but this has given them freedom. From the Street of Eternal Happiness in Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's an interactive map, some videos, a slideshow of the Shanghai Harley guys, and more details from Rob's reporting on this series online. Marketplace.org is the website.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in keeping with the theme that Heidi started up at the top of the broadcast, Federal Reserve policy decisions are like what kind of foods? Here's Nassim Taleb, you've heard of his book, The Black Swan, probably, talking on Bloomberg TV about the Fed's last whack at quantitative easing. This was almost 2 years ago.
It's just like a ketchup bottle you're pouring. Ketchup and nothing's coming out, and then you make a statement like Bernanke that you have evidence that this is working, all right, okay, that there's no risk, and then suddenly the whole ketchup
right, coats your french fries,
coats your everything, the whole table, everything, your face, everything.
And it's a big old mess. We've got more analogies, some good ones too, online, marketplace.org. And with that, we're done. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.